Bad news.
Bad news for the state.
Bad news for capital.
Bad news for patriarchy.
Bad news for all forms of domination.
Bad news. Angry voices from around the world.
Our monthly info show from anarchist and anti-authoritarian radio projects worldwide.
If these news are bad, I don't want to be good.
Greetings, comrades, and welcome to Bad News, Angry Voices from Around the World, for December 2017, a product of the International Anarchist and Anti-Authoritarian Radios Network. This month, we'll hear the following segments from member groups. First, 105 FM presents on local news from Lesvos Island and other Aegean islands, refugee struggles, the occupation of the Syriza headquarters, and the trial of the head of the Greek fascist party, the Golden Dawn. Next, we'll hear from Radio Caruf in so-called Chile about the murder of Mapuche youth Rafael Nahuatl in the Argentinian portions of Hualmapu. After that, we journey over to Germany for A Radio Berlin's presentation of a report about repression against the radical left concerning the anti-G20 demonstrations in Hamburg this summer and continuing up into December in other parts of Germany. Following this, Radio Fragmata from Athens tells us about organizing against the new correctional code in Greece. That's followed by a segment with Lori Love, who's fighting extradition to the United States from the UK for charges of hacking. After that, Radios of Subversive Expression from Athens gives updates about the eviction of the Gar squat and the hunger strikes and solidarity with Paula and Nico. Following that, we get a report from comrades at Chernolucnia from Ljubljana, Slovenia, about the ecological resistors in Germany's Rhineland region against the lignite brown coal pit mine in the old-growth Hambacher Forest. Finally, the final straw, that's us, airs the latest segment of the Drop J20 podcast, updating listeners to the latest details in the first segment of trials of 194 anti-fascist and anti-capitalist protesters facing up to 60 years in U.S. prisons for anti-Trump inauguration demonstrations in January of 2017. If you'd like to find out more about the projects involved in the A Radio Network, learn more about our work, or hear our past episodes of Bad News, Angry Voices from Around the World, check out the website a-radio-network.org.
You're listening to 105 FM.
The independent, self-organized radio station of Mytilene at Lesvos Island.
It's the melody of rage that unites us.
Hello comrades, this is the broadcast of counter-information of the self-organized independent radio station of Mytilene, Lesvos Island, 105 FM. We will inform you about local news from Lesvos and other Aegean islands that occurred during the months of November to December. We will discuss about the occupation of Syriza offices in Lesvos and about the trial of the fascist former director of the 6th Gymnasium of Mytilene, Vasilis Makripoulias.
On the 7th of November, another refugee took his life by hanging himself in the concentration camp of Moria. On the 8th of November, which is a national holiday here in Lesvos, the mayor and the cops teared down from the square the banners that the refugees had. Taxi drivers helped by hiding the banners in their taxis. Three refugees were arrested. All of them were released. On 20th of November, a fascist demonstration was held by the mayor demanding the decontamination of the island. Later that day, a demonstration took place by the strangled refugees and solidarity people.
On the 21st of November, authorities and fascists made the refugees take down their tents. They also forbid them to stay at the square. After that, they transferred them to PIKPA, an NGO center, despite their objection. On the 22nd of November, the struggling refugees tried to reach Sapfo Square to continue their protest, since the previous day the cops and the other authorities prohibited their accommodation but not their right to protest there. However, cops and fascists attacked them violently, injuring three of them.
On the 25th of November, a demonstration was held by refugees and solidarity people and ended up at the Syriza offices, the governing party, which it was occupied. the demands are the immediate release of Hesam Sa'eri Hezari, the imprisoned member of the protesting refugees, the removal of the geographical restrictions of movement for all the protesting refugees in order to proceed to Athens, and governmental guarantee that none of the protesters will be detained and or deported upon arrival in Athens. The accommodation of every protesting refugee upon arrival in Athens.
During the occupation, which is still going on, several actions took place in order for the current situation to be known, not only the local society. The stand of Syriza was very hostile in the first days, but later they tried to approach the members of the squad by giving fake promises that the demands will be fulfilled.
The meeting that took place on the 5th of December in Athens between the Prime Minister and the mayors of Aegean islands of Lesbos, Chios and Samos reached the decision of the transportation of 1,000 refugees until the 9th of December. The place where these people will be transferred to have not been clarified.
On the 16th of November, Vasilis Makripoulias was trialed and he was acquitted. The former director of the 6th Gymnasium of Mytilene, Vasilis Makripoulias, hid from 2012 to January 2017 the sexual harassment cases of school children by the owner of the school's canteen, Vasilis Kehagias.
Hello, comrades. This is the report of December 2017 from Radio Kuruf in Chilean region. In this opportunity, we are going to talk about another murder of Mapuche people in Argentina.
Until the 19th century, the ancestral territory of Mapuche people extended between the region now occupied by Chile and Argentina. State that started an extermination war against these people since then. On the Argentinian zone, Mapuche territory is named Puelmapu. And a couple of weeks ago, this place had the attention of the world because of the murder of the young anarchist Santiago Maldonado, who supported the fight of land recovery in a Mapuche community. We now again look with sorrow at Puelmapu due to the death of the young Mapuche Rafael Nahuel, who was murdered last November 25. It happened when the federal forces attacked the Lofken Winkul Mapu, located near the Mascardi Lake, near Bariloche City, in a recently recovered territory.
Because of the brutal repression with lead bullets, several people were wounded and Rafael arrived without life at the hospital of Bariloche. The two Mapuche comrades who took him to the hospital were heavily tortured by the police.
The local press said, after the clash with federal forces, there was a death in Villa Mascardi, as if it was an isolated case and not the outcome of police repression. Although there are not weapons found in the place, the security minister, Patricia Bullrich, insists that there was an ambush with heavy weapons against the police, which responded killing the young Rafael Nahuel.
The people of the Mapuche community said that it was not a raid. Instead, it was a direct racist hand of Mapuche people.
From the Lofken Winkul Mapu, the people say, "We will keep on resisting and fighting against the repression of the usurper and capitalist state that aims to take over our ancestral territory."
The government killed him. Stop repression against the Mapuche people. Land and freedom.
Sagen Sie jetzt mal bitte
Anarchie.
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 Ob geschichtlich oder brandaktuell.
Mit Berichten und Interviews, mit Beiträgen und Collagen
beleuchtet das anarchistische Radio Berlin das Phänomen des Anarchismus.
Viva Anarchia!
Greetings and solidarity from us at A-Radio Berlin. In our contribution to this month's Bad News, we want to share some information about the current G20 repression by the German state, as well as what seems to be the start of an intensification of repression against leftist movements overall in Germany. So, what happened? Well, besides a lot of court cases that already took place and which led to some sentences, and more to be expected, there's now been a series of house raids which the cops carried out on the 4th of December. Overall, 24 places have been raided, targeting 22 people, of which all had been initially arrested during an anti-G20 demo in July in Hamburg, following heavy physical attacks by the police. And even though there's clear video evidence by the police that shows how the cops had attacked and beaten up this demo, the state still claims that these people would have been involved with property damage that occurred at the same time on that day. These claims were made during a press conference of the cops, and at this point, also looking back on the communication of the cops in the last month, we can observe that they try to more and more act as a semi-autonomous political actor, having a certain media strategy. One that is unsurprisingly strongly aligned against any left-radical activities and groups. The press conference we mentioned was visited by someone from Hamburg's free radio FSK, who reported about it to another free radio here in Berlin.
They claim that this small demonstration with maybe 100 people was part of what happened at the same morning in the Elbchaussee, namely the torching of cars. This is a bold accusation, which was also presented quite stoically. And how that's supposed to have worked? The evidence for it, we are very curious to hear. Because what we know is that this demo was attacked and completely beaten down by the cops. A lot of the people in the demo sustained heavy injuries and were brought to hospitals. How these people were at the same time supposedly able to torch cars in the Elbchaussee, that will be very interesting to hear.
Of course, there has been no evidence at all for any of that. But the legal grounds of the house raids that happened now are based on the accusation that these 22 people were assembling not to protest the G20 summit, but actually just to break the peace. Breaking peace is a very common charge that the state tries to use against protesters. Though it is still surprising in this case, since it is used against all of the involved protesters, not minding what anybody of them actually did. The cops are thereby basically trying to bypass the constitutionally guaranteed right to protest by claiming that these 22 people should be regarded not as protesters but actually as a group similar to football hooligans. The background for that is that a German court did decide in a case of violent confrontation between two football hooligan groups that everybody involved, independent of what they did, if they hit or hurt anyone or not, can be charged. The police is now using this ruling to charge all of the 22 people with breaking the peace. But it is not unlikely that this attempt by the police to undermine the constitution will be reprimanded, since the court that made this decision clearly stated that this ruling cannot be used in the context of a political demonstration. Well, if that's the case, why did the cops then still try to do it this way? Two answers stand out for us. First, it seems more and more clear now that the strategy of the police is to influence public discourse in a way that denounces and discredits any leftist dissent and protest as not being political, but actually just criminal, violent, or terrorist. Secondly, it is usual police practice to act on shady legal grounds because there's little consequence if their actions are deemed illegal later. And it allowed them to gather quite some equipment and data that can be used for further repression.
The cops are very proud of all the loot of electronic devices they got through the raids. They want to use them to research the structures of the left. Thankfully, they finally admitted that this was the aim of the house raids and that they also want to continue in this way. And the conference of the German Ministries of the Interior, which happened recently in Leipzig, issued the statement that they aim to, quote unquote, reach the core of the leftist scene.
So it is quite clear that the state's aim is to align public opinion against the anti-capitalist radical movements. And it is quite sad, though also unsurprising, to see the mass media playing along, reproducing the police media releases uncritically and rarely questioning the story of a threatening left from which the public needs to be protected. With that, it seems that another piece of information that the police gave out during the press conference will be reality soon. Reminding us all of the 70s and the prosecution of the RAF, the police said they want to use pictures of suspects in the mass media in the future.
It shows that they want to create a social climate in which leftist people are being regarded as outlaws, people you don't associate with, people you denounce. It seems not only the police was unhappy to see that the protests of the summit had a lot of deep sympathy within the population, and that there are also a lot of people who imagine different alternatives than fascism to the current situation of this ongoing crisis regime.
Well, it seems the right-wing shift in Germany now also takes more concrete shape in terms of state repression. No more excuses for having unencrypted equipment, and much need for solidarity and our own convictions. This is for us in this month. Take care and stay strong.
If you would like to listen to more audios and news from A Radio Berlin, you can visit our website aradio.blogsport.de
and check us out on Twitter at @aradio_Berlin.
Hello, this is Bad News from Radio Fragmata Anarchist Web Radio from Athens, Greece, about the mobilizations against the new correctional code. On October 16th of 2017, the new correctional code was filed for public consultation. In the 88 articles of the new correctional code, behind his blurred and vague formulations, there is a simple and straightforward translation. The return of Type C prisons regime and the replacement of permits and suspensions through the establishment of the electronic wristband and home confinement. In the new correctional code, the existing authoritarian dominions of the prosecutor are expanded, not at all accidentally, as the chairman of the correctional code writing committee is the prosecutor of the Court of Appeal, Panayotis Brakoumatsos. And all this under the mantle of progressive humanism invoked by the Ministry of Justice. It's like placing the executioner to take care of the health of his victims. Special conditions of detention in police stations and security sections, prohibition of communication with other prisoners, and isolation, Article 11, paragraphs 4 and 6, part K. Degrading physical checks with the denudation of the prisoners, Article 21, paragraph 7. Suspension of educational permits and possibility of classes attendance termination, Article 33, paragraph 9. Electronic recording of any communication of the prisoner, Article 51, paragraph 1. Replacement of the prisoner's permits by the insertion of electronic surveillance, wristband, or home confinement, Article 52, paragraph 4, mainly for foreign prisoners, and Article 54, paragraph 3, for almost all the prisoners. There weren't restrictions in Article 56 of the former correctional code. Additional restrictions on educational permits by judiciary's decisions, Article 56, paragraphs 1 and 4. Parole's replacement and release from prison under terms by the insertion of home confinement, Article 58, paragraph 4. Article 60 of the former correctional code did not introduce such restrictions. And all this under the absolute authority of the prosecutor, who has the capability, Article 53, paragraph 4, to contest any positive proposal by the majority of the prison's council and appeal to the Court of Penalties rejecting the prisoner's permits. Also, the promotion of the electronic wristband and the house arrest, rather than the permit and the suspension, is not an alternative serving time, but a new prison sentence that did not exist. That is why we demand 1. The prosecution's veto abolition, Article 53, paragraph 4. The prison's council should decide democratically by majority, and its decision should not be contested by the prosecutor's appeal. 2. The legislation of the permit as the right of the prisoner and not as a benefit, since there are no active disciplinary measures against him or her. Article 66 of the new Correctional Code, Disciplinary Offences, essentially assesses the daily behaviour of the prisoner in every activity inside the prison. Since the prisoner has not been guilty of misconduct in the period of his licence, his assessment can only be positive in terms of authorization. Otherwise, legitimate questions are arisen as for the transparency of the process and the existence of other expediencies. Personal malice, vindictiveness, extortion for bribery. 3. The withdrawal of the home detention or electronic wristband scenario instead of a regular license, Article 54, paragraph 3, the ironic verbiage, the consent of the convict is required. In the former correctional code, in Article 56, there was no such restriction that effectively invalidates the right of license. 4. The abolition of the case of home confinement with an electronic wristband replacing the conditional dismissal of the prisoner, Article 58, note of paragraph 4, which was not in Article 60 of the former correctional code. 5. Electronic surveillance or the measure of home confinement may work in a previous period from the prisoner's license or the prisoner's release as a probationary test rather than as a replacement. 6. The immediate withdrawal of the regulation for the reintroduction of special conditions C-type prisons regime, New Democracy governments and its former minister Charalambos Athanasiou inspiration, as it is imprinted in the Article 11, paragraph 4, prisoners' observation and isolation in police stations and facilities instead of detention facilities, and paragraph 6 in particular, as it is described in Part E. 7. The correction of the Article 21, paragraph 7, concerning the humiliating denigration of the prisoner for his strip search. There are also electronic means that ensure the control of any illegal object or substances without the need for the denudation of the prisoner that resembles other errors. 8. The withdrawal of the suspension of the training of the prisoner as it is defined in Article 33, paragraph 9. The education of the prisoner must be his, her, inalienable right, and its suspension only negatively affects his or her character. 9. The abolition of the electronic file of people contacting the prisoners as it is prescribed by the Article 51, paragraph 1. 10. The withdrawal of the note in paragraph 1 of the Article 56 about the opinion of a judicial officer ordering the temporary detention of a prisoner and may contest his or her right to educational permit, or at least the enactment of a 12-month time limit, since the court has not been done, for the opinion from the beginning date of the prosecution, so that the prisoner not completely be alienated from his or her studies. 11. The expansion of the possibility for studying prisoners' attendance without the arbitrary and anti-educational restrictions as they are formulated in the Article 56, paragraphs 2 and 4. 12. The withdrawal of the paragraph 3 in the Article 31, which basically cancels the prisoner's right to hunger strike, allowing torture of compulsory feeding by magistrate's order. PS1. In the men's prisons, we stay open at noon and refuse the block of our cells, claiming our suggestions to be accepted that heal the abortion of the new correctional code from 13th of October 2017. This is the first move in an escalation series that will follow in all prisons in case we meet against us, except for the prison walls, also walls of communications and revision of the correctional code by the Ministry of Justice. PS2. In the women's prison from 26th of September of 2017, we extended our mobilization against the new correctional code, remaining outside of our cells at noon, head count, and keeping the country yard open until 7:30 in the afternoon. It is closing at 5:30. If the Ministry of Justice once again selectively deviates from our righteous demands, our mobilizations will be escalated. PS3. The above text with our demands and positions as prisoners will be sent to all the prisons in Greece in order to create and expand a mayor fight front that will in practice abolish the new fascist correctional code. This was the announcement, the official announcement of struggle for women's men's Korydallos prison, wings A, B, C, D, and A position of the underground annex. At the same time, on 11th of November of 2017, the comrades Nikos Masiotis and Paula Rupa, members of the revolutionary struggle, commenced a hunger strike with the following demands. 1. Withdraw the provision in Article 11, paragraphs 6, part E and 4 of the same article regarding the detention in police stations. Do not bring back the Type C prison regime. 2. Immediate release Nikos Masiotis from the isolation in which he is held by a decision of the ministry since last July. 3. Introduce regulation to the correctional code for the elasticity of visiting hours based on the frequency of visit a prisoner has. For example, a prisoner who has one time visit per month or doesn't have at all should be able to extend the duration of the meeting. 4. There should be a dedicated visiting room for the parents to meet with their children. There is no such place in the Korydallos men's prison. And when the frequency of the meetings is rare, the duration of the meeting should be increased accordingly. In order to achieve at least the bare minimum coverage of our child's needs, first of all, to communicate with us due to the inability to visit us often, we request 1. Visiting time with our child to last at least 3 hours. 2. Visiting time between us 2 hours. 3. Equivalent regulations to be stipulated for other analogous cases, while the minimum time for parents' meetings with their children should be extended. At last is the updating from the prisons, aggregate of the Committee Against the Correctional Code. Date, 1st of December of 2017. So far, in the nationwide mobilization against the fascist provisions of the new correctional code, the following prisons are involved. 1. Korydallos women's prisons. 2. Korydallos men's prison, underground annex A position. 3. Saint Stefanou prison, Patra. 4. Larissa prison. 5. Hania prison. 6. Malandrinos prison. 7. Domokos prison. Briefing to other prisons is continued as part of the creation of a nationwide struggle network. The fact that the Ministry of Justice froze the process of voting on the new correctional code while facing the determination and expansion of our struggle may be a victory, but it does not cover us in any way. Because the days, the months, the years inside the prisons do not freeze, but they are dissipated, locked up. immediate indulgence of the demands of the Committee of Struggle against the new correctional code until the victory.
Hello and welcome to This is an Island segment for Bad News 7 from London. This month, our show featured an interview with activist Lori Love, who is faced with extradition to the United States.
So Lori's appeal against extradition will be heard at the Royal Courts of Justice in London on the 28th and 29th of November, so that's just a couple weeks from today. Could you give our listeners some context to the case? I know there's a huge backlog of information, but in essence, what has happened and why are you, Lori, in danger of being extradited?
My involvement has been for about 4 years in the legal system, just over 4 years ago, on October the 25th, 2013. I was arrested, or, well, so a guy dressed as a UPS delivery guy turned up with a parcel at the door, and I was asked to come down and get it. But instead of a parcel, I got arrested, and the house was searched for about 5 hours, and all of the computers and anything digital, anything that could store information, was removed, and I was taken to a police station, kept overnight, and then questioned for a few hours the next day, and then released without charge. But the arrest was under the Computer Misuse Act. They asked me questions about some compromises of US government computer systems. Then, a few months later, I was served with a Section 49 Reaper notice, which is a court order under the Regulation of Investigatory Powers Act, which in theory compels the subject to assist with passwords, decryption information, generally render information more legible and comprehensible. I didn't feel compelled and I wasn't charged under that. So after 9 months of being on bail without charges, I was released from bail. And about a year later, I was rearrested under the Extradition Act by the Metropolitan Police. And so for the last 2 years, I've been on extradition bail, trying to oppose that. We had a hearing at Westminster Magistrates Court, and 3 days of hearing, and we lost that case, despite a lot of the evidence being accepted in our favour from expert witnesses, etc. And luckily, we got leave to appeal last April, so we're having this appeal heard, as you said, in a couple of weeks. The why the context is what I'm accused of being involved in was a protest in 2013 after the tragic death of a young man called Aaron Swartz. And Aaron Swartz was an activist. He believed in access to information, transparency in government, the use of technology for civic purposes to make a better society. He opposed some bad legislation in the US that was called SOPA and CISPA, the copyright cartel Hollywood trying to get rights to get more people under piracy. And CISPA was indemnifying service providers from effectively snitching on their customers to the government under the context of information sharing for security. So he opposed these. He led this campaign. Eventually, Wikipedia, Google, Amazon all blacked out. Congress got the message and it was stopped. A year or so later, he got into trouble at MIT campus for downloading too many scientific journal articles, which doesn't sound like the kind of thing that would get you in serious trouble. But the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, under which he was charged and under which I would theoretically be prosecuted in the USA, is so broad that it creates a felony out of exceeding the terms of use. So if Facebook changed their terms and conditions that none of you will have read, but you will have all accepted if you use Facebook, so that you can't use it if you're wearing purple socks, and one day you used it wearing purple socks, that would be enough for the Department of Justice to prosecute you under Computer Fraud and Abuse Act. He wanted to get a lot of scientific articles from JSTOR. He had the right to use MIT campus, and he had the right to access the journals. He just borrowed too many, you know, not like they were finite and it's not like anyone else couldn't access them. He just, you know, was a bit cheeky with the bandwidth. Because of who he was and his activism, the Department of Justice, as part of a wider campaign against activists and hackers and anyone involved in information transparency and government accountability, they chose to make an example out of him, charged him under the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act. He was facing 33 years in prison, many millions of dollars fine if he fought his case, asserted his right to a fair trial and to plead his innocence for what was obviously not a crime, or to plead guilty and to take 6 months to a year in prison, $1 million fine, not to be able to hold office or vote. And sadly, that choice led Aaron to hang himself in January of 2013, which was a great tragedy and caused a lot of upset to a lot of people. And there were various efforts to instigate reform of the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act and more generally the coercive plea bargaining system that allows prosecutors to stack the charges up so much that you're strong-armed into pleading guilty unless you happen to be a man of conviction or a person of conviction, and that's very difficult for you, then you can end up in a situation like Aaron did. So these took many forms. There was congressional efforts where people from the tech industry spoke up. There was also a hacktivist campaign under the branding of Anonymous, and through that, various computer networks were compromised, and a message suggesting that this Computer Fraud and Abuse Act be reformed and the general criminal justice system be reformed was put out. So I'm accused of being involved in that. Many people would say it's an act of political protest rather than an act of criminality, and sadly, in the 4 years since my original arrest, the USA has had to provide no evidence whatsoever linking me to the crime, so I can't even speak about why I might have been involved, because I may not have been involved, and it's quite disturbing that I have been ordered to be extradited, as it's passed the Westminster Magistrates Court, and it's also been signed by the Home Secretary without the USA producing a shred of evidence. So there's nothing that would differentiate me in this position from anyone else that they would have chosen to make a case against. The loudest protestations of innocence would have meant nothing procedurally in the hearing and means nothing to the Home Secretary. So that's context.
What kind of evidence has the court offered? There's no evidence.
No. So
on what grounds then can the extradition actually go forward?
The extradition treaty between the UK and the US was brought in by Tony Blair in 2003, so it's something else that we have to thank him for. It was brought in after 9/11 because terrorism, you know, and it was only going to be used against brown people and Muslims, so everyone could get together and hate and come up with laws to oppress them. But then, as always happens, it can just be used against anyone.
And here is Andy's synopsis of the case in terms of the law surrounding it.
It's not necessarily the end of the road for Laurie. There is a possibility that he can have an appeal to the Supreme Court after, if they should lose this. There's a danger, of course, that the CPS, on behalf of the US government, may appeal themselves to the Supreme Court. So it's still very much up in the balance, and I won't go too far into what happened, but in terms of how it goes at Hogwarts, as we call the Royal Courts of Justice, fortunately, his barrister, Mr. Fitzgerald, did not go and have a few jars and gave a really excellent speech on his behalf, so fingers crossed for Laurie, and we hope he will do well.
And that's all from us for now. See you next time for some more bad news.
Radios of subversive expression. Radios of subversive expression from Athens.
On Sunday morning, the 26th of November, riot police along with other enforcement units invade and evacuate Gare Squad, arresting four comrades that were present during the operation. The arrested squatters were transferred in the police headquarters in Athens in order to be prosecuted, while another group of comrades, which were randomly driving by the spot at the moment, got also arrested a few blocks away due to witnessing and reacting to police invasion. The reflexes were sharp, and thus solidarity campaigns started quickly, resulting in protests outside Gaza, demos and public interventions throughout Greece and even beyond borders, giving out a loud message against police and state brutality. After being held for 4 days and going through trial, all arrested comrades were finally released from charges, and soon, on the 2nd of December, the building got reoccupied, giving out a loud message that we're not willing to surrender. On the same day, a number of collective public events took place in Gare, not only in terms of claiming the squad and its publicly addressed infrastructures, rather than highlighting the importance of resisting and fighting against authority and state domination. Through this aspect, they called out for a massive protest on the upcoming 6th of December demo, as matters of defending our grounds of struggle and our lives in general against all forms of suppression and control. Nine years have passed since the assassination of Alexandros Grigoropoulos, a 15-year-old student from a CAP in the neighborhood of Exarchia. The days and weeks that followed this Saturday night of 2008, Athens was ablaze and the revolt took place. Many public buildings were occupied, collective actions were organized, and of course marching, manifesting, and rioting became everyday activities. The slogan of these days was, "Discipline has ended, life is magical." In 2017, life is not so magical, and the demo of December 6th was relatively quiet. Nevertheless, there were at least 2,000 people in this demo from various political origins, and the tempo was quite lively. The demo continued later with hundreds of people rioting in Exarchia. 16 people were arrested when 22 were detained by the police.
During the past 2 months, the prisoners have started a series of actions that gradually took the form of a massive mobilization among different correctional facilities, demanding the withdrawal of the new penal code that was introduced on the 16th of October and was then set into public debate. Namely, to sum up the major points of this new penalty regime for the imprisoned, the suggested changes are actually an attempt to reinstate the establishment of maximum security prisons and facilities, as well as to introduce new harder terms and disciplinary measures as far home detention penalty, the prisoners' visiting hours and authorized guests' educational permits and served time leaves, depriving them of their fundamental rights that were gained over struggle. Solitary and cruel conditions of confinement are to get imposed, implying special treatment on the cases of political prisoners. The first reactions were already noted in late September when the prisoners started the struggle, more specifically in the women's wing of Korydallos prisons, to be soon spread over the male's wing, resulting in the constitution of the Committee of Struggle. Over the past 2 months, the actions against the legislative monstrosity proliferated and escalated, supported by groups from other prisons joining the common struggle and also by the solidarity movement, which subsequently has been organizing meetings, demos and interventions. On the 2nd of December, the President of Justice Department and Coordinator of Correctional Facilities, Pavlos Doulamis, had a brief meeting with the Committee of Struggle in order to discuss over the demands of the prisoners, while on the same day a group of solidarians gathered outside the house of the Minister of Justice, Kondonis, to protest against the new penal system and the harsh treatment of the prisoners. On the 3rd of December, another protest was held outside the Janio Hospital in solidarity with the political prisoners, Paula Rupa and Nikos Masiotis, that were transferred there after being in a hunger strike for almost a month, fighting respectively against the new legislative system and the vindictive manipulations towards them by the state. During the protest, two comrades were got in custody to be released a few hours later.
The couple Paula Rupa and Nikos Masiotis, both imprisoned members of a revolutionary struggle and parents of a child with whom they cannot communicate as much as they'd wish to, have gone on hunger strike since November 11th. Here is the declaration of their advocate. After 28 days of hunger strike, the health of Nikos Masiotis and Paula Rupa has been dangerously deteriorated, while the Ministry of Justice is playing deaf and does not respond to requests that concern it.
Specifically, Nikos Masiotis, who has made various hunger strikes in the past, such as the 35-day strike in 2015 for the elimination of prison type C, and more recently the 4-day hunger and thirst strike in January 2017, along with Paula Rupa, for the illegal detention and confinement of their son in the psychiatric clinic of the Children's Hospital. He now faces an immediate danger for his life, according to a cardiologist's diagnosis this day.
No bastard ever came home from earning $8.25 an hour feeling proud. Minimum wage? Just a fancy term for industrialized slavery. We're in a war. A war with the privileged. Those aren't streets you're sitting on. They're battlefields. And it is our duty to fight the comfortable and the overfed. So go forth, you sons of bitches.
Iz bojišća razredne vojne poruča Črna Luknja.
Pozdravljeni, še vedno smo v Etru, ekipa Črne Luknje. V Etru z nami tudi tovarišija iz Nemčije, s katero bomo se dotikali tem ekoloških bojev in v Nemčiji in širše. Konkretno bomo govorili o širšem protestnem gibanju, ki je drugače znano pod imenom Ende Gelände. Za potrebe intervjuja bomo seveda pač preskočili v angleščino. So welcome here in the studio of Radio Student. With you we will talk today about this white protest movement known under the name Ende Gelände. So first to start with, we all know that this topic mobilizes a lot of people in Germany, like climate justice. So it would be good to start with the context in Germany. What triggered the resistance? What is like the current situation that is so unbearable that people have the need to speak about it and to change it?
Yeah, right. First, thank you for inviting us. And we are two activists from Germany who are involved in the Ende Gelände and climate justice movement. Maybe to give a small overview about the context of Ende Gelände. They're actually in Germany, and it's called Rhineland. It's in part of Germany which is close to Bonn and Cologne in the western part. There are three huge coal mines that are run by RWE, which is the biggest energy company in Germany. And actually this area of Rhineland is, and RWE is the biggest carbon dioxide producer in Europe, and they have like several power plants. So what RWE is actually doing is that they are cutting down the oldest forest in Germany, which is called Hambacher Forst, you might have heard about. And they are extracting lignite, brown coal, to extend their coal mines and to burn it. And yeah, lignite is actually one of the most dirty fossil fuel, which is responsible for a huge amount of, like, a really high emission of carbon, and which is at the same time a really strong kind of engine of climate change in the world. And it's obviously that, like, in the global north, like the rich industrial countries are actually producing the most of CO2 emissions and destroying the climate a lot. And at the same time, the global south, like the rather poor countries in the world, are the ones who are suffering the most of this climate change. And like, what does it mean as consequence on the global level? Means that there's an extreme, they're developing extreme climate conditions, really bad harvests, and a lack of water, which can lead to a war of, a war on resources, actually. And there's a lot of land grabbing taking part. And like, the consequences is a lot that people are forced to leave their home countries, and it actually, like, climate change actually produces it's migration also.
Yeah, and also besides these consequences of a global level, there are big problems on the local level in Germany as well, because you can imagine the coal mine is a really huge hole. It's have a depth of 600 meters, and it's that big that the city of Cologne would fit inside. So there's a huge destruction of the landscape, and also for this open coal mine, there are villages who have to be removed. So the energy company are forcing people to resettle at another place, and the people are just getting some money in the value of the house from RWE, and there is a big pressure that they can that they have to leave their homes. So RWE is destroying the villages and the local communities, and it's based on a law which is actually made by Hitler, and it's a law about that the state can is allowed to take property from the people if there is a higher society interest of it.
So how was the resistance formed? Could you tell us a bit more about Ende Gelände? Like, how did it start and how is it structured?
There was resistance by the local people who are actually affected by the... It's also kind of a land grabbing by RWE that, as was just told, there is for years already a resistance by the local people to try to stay at their homes and to defend their homes and their also like their history they had at this place. And since 2010, There was the climate justice movement in Germany rose by making organizing a first climate camp by grassroots activists against coal mining. And since then, it's taking part every year, this climate camp. And also, the as we said before, it's the oldest forest in Germany, which is affected by the coal mining, the Hambacher Forest. That was occupied by autonomous activists in 2012 and is still occupied. And maybe like the climate camp, which is the kind of the base of Ende Gelände action, and that's actually the place where Ende Gelände, it was the kind of place of birth of Ende Gelände. The climate camp is a self-organized protest camp, and which is kind of consisting of different pillars in the organizing, which means like there's on the one hand there's it consists of actions, direct actions, but also the mass civil disobedience, which is Ende Gelände, but also autonomous action, and then further on there's like another pillar is the trial to a practice of living together in a sustainable and emancipatory way, like just to practice how to live together, finding consensus and like this. And moreover, there's one important issue of the climate camp is also networking between different social struggles or different political groups and movements that are coming together, but also networking with the local communities that are living actually where Ende Gelände is taking place and where the climate camp is taking place. And the other thing is the educational part, which means that we want to educate ourselves in terms of anti-capitalistic issues and contents. And it's like taking place in the way of like workshops and discussions and speeches and action trainings also. And maybe to give you one example, for this year in the climate camp 2017 in the summer, there was actually this year a big focus also on the feminist networking, and there were like many feminists meeting together, and at the same time there was also for the first time actually on the climate camp the issue of critical maleness coming up. So that is kind of an important topic, which is also continuing by several workshops, several network meetings, how to deal in a critical way with maleness in the behavior level, and also how to organize in a political way in political groups, but also how to make direct actions or mass actions with at the same time having the sensitivity of machoism, and to deconstruct maleness and to try to deconstruct the binarity of genders, and also to have the focus on actually who is speaking, who is facilitating meetings, and who is in the front, that it's not only men, but that it's like kind of one important topic we had this year and that will hopefully continue.
So it seems that there is a broader political context to the movement under the name Ende Gelände, but you were saying about as well as outside, as well as on the inside of the organization. Maybe it would be interesting to hear some commentaries or opinion or experiences on the type of actions. So Ende Gelände is a mass action that is somehow squeezed into one weekend's time. So people get politicized. But what comes after that? Like, because we said that climate justice is an important topic that is rooted in the broader political context. So how do those people organize themselves after this concrete weekend of actions? What are the possibilities to engage themselves around this question?
They are Ende Gelände is more for like one big weekend, and so that many people are coming together and locate the infrastructure of the coal mines. But as well, there are local groups of Ende Gelände who are acting in different cities of Germany, And also it's there's a, it's really important for Ende Gelände to get involved in the local with the local people and to invite them to come to the climate camp to have discussions together. And also it's a big topic to talk about this because a lot of local people are actually working at RWE. And that somehow there's a, like that we talk about also with the worker unions that we don't want to avoid the working places, but that we more rather would like to change the working places into more like sustainable or renewable energy working places.
And maybe like to tell a bit more about Ende Gelände as action. It was said, it's a mass action of civil disobedience, which is on the one hand, it got really powerful. It was the first time in 2015. And since then it's actually growing because there's like a huge international mobilization. And there's actually many people from all over Europe coming and joining the action. And as you maybe know the pictures, then there's like thousands of people trying to enter the mine. And there's a lot of media attention, which gives the movement more power in an international way also. But what I would say is quite special and also was new in Germany was that thousands of people actually took part in an action without giving their IDs, so they stayed anonymously, which like in terms of repression by police and by the state was quite of a big protection, because then the police was like just they couldn't deal with that because they didn't have the infrastructure to take our IDs by fingerprinting everybody, by photographing everybody. So that was a good protection. And since then, it's working like every year like this and with quite a big success. And also there's a success in you actually can see that RWE, the energy concern, needs to shut down the power plants. So it's, and it's successful and it's growing.
And talking about direct actions, I'm sure that you also need a lot of legal support. How do you organize on this level?
There is a extra legal team for all, which are people who know a lot about the law circumstances. And if you have questions, they can answer them. And also they are doing prisoner support in case some people have to go in prison for a short time after the actions. And this group is like for these issues there.
And it's organized for all the people who are joining, whether they're doing their own autonomous actions or they're joining the action that it's most visible in the media, like it's sort of a symbol of Ende Gelände, like people wearing white clothes. So it covers all the actions that are engaging around this area at that time, the legal group.
They do. And actually, it's not only Ende Gelände. Ende Gelände is the most visible part, I would say. But at the same time, there's also like more, on a legal way, more low level demonstrations by citizens, also locals that are taking part. And also autonomous actions, direct actions that are not within the organizing frame of Ende Gelände. And one step back for the organizing of Ende Gelände, it's maybe interesting to hear how they organize, because they have kind of this, we call it finger system. If you imagine a hand, then the hand would be kind of the climate camp as a base of action, of organizing, of action trainings, of legal trainings, and so on. And where also like a solidarity kitchen is providing food for all, and also mobile, like if people are in the mine, they are trying to get as close as possible to the mine to bring them food and to support them. And at the same time, from the base of the climate camp, different fingers, like different groups of activists are entering the mine or blocking infrastructure. It could also be like the train tracks or the storage of the coal. And they're coming from different sides, so which is one tactic. Because the as it was said before, the mine is super huge, so it's not not possible for the police to block the whole mine to stop us to enter the mine.
Okay, nice. So it seems like a very well prepared structure, and as it is an ongoing struggle, I guess we will also be a part maybe also of Ende Gelände next year. Could you tell us maybe where we can find more info about it?
Yeah, there are two links on the homepage of the radio, and about from Ende Gelände, and it's also in English, and from the climate camp. And for next year, there's still discussion going on which action will take place and where it will take place. But there will be some action for sure. And we can keep you updated.
Perfect. Nice. So thanks a lot for joining us in the studio today. We will try to also bring your updates to our listeners in our further shows when the information will be more clear. But for today, that's it. So thanks a lot. Mi pa se vračamo nazaj v studio, torej to je bil srednji del oddaje na temo okoljskih bojev v Nemčiji. Pa v bistvu zaključimo to vsebinski del z enim komadom, pol pa se vrnemo še nazaj z napovedmi.
What's a revolution to you? To kill their bosses and take their money.
Revolution! Revolution! Dobro, kako ti možeš u jednoj demokratskoj državi dizat narod na ustanak?
On January 20th, over 230 people were indiscriminately attacked, kettled, and mass arrested by Metropolitan Police during an anti-capitalist and anti-fascist march held in opposition to Trump's ascension to power. After being held on the streets for the majority of the winter day without access to medical treatment, bathrooms, food, or water, those arrested, including journalists, medics, and legal observers, were all charged with the same 8 blanket felony charges, and in some cases, even more. After months of solidarity and countless hearings, a couple of the charges have been reduced or dropped. But the government continues to stubbornly pursue the prosecution of almost 200 people, most of them still facing at least 6 felony charges and up to 60 years in prison. Most of the prosecution's case is premised on criminalizing common protest practices, such as wearing the same clothing, chanting, presence of medics and legal observers, and meeting at a predetermined location for a publicly announced march. Despite this, U.S. Attorney Liu, a member of Trump's transition team, is still pursuing these charges in order to deliver a broad blow to dissent everywhere, as well as to avoid scrutiny of the widely condemned violent and excessive police behavior during the inauguration that even children, the elderly, and disabled people were not safe from. While the officers that hurt people that day have yet to face any repercussions, our charges are getting underway, and here's what's been happening.
As the first of many J20 conspiracy case trials draws to a close, we have a lot to catch you up on. Sorry for the delay with this update. It turns out that fighting state repression is exhausting. First, a sliver of good news. On Wednesday, December 13th, during a hearing on a motion for judgment of acquittal, Judge Lynn Leibowitz stated that there was no evidence that any of these defendants were, quote, leaders or organizers, but claimed that even simply yelling, "Stay together," or "Keep moving," normal utterances in a protest, could be reasonable proof of the charge. One less felony, but during the hearing, the judge maintained that all the other charges were reasonable within the law. While welcome news, the inciting a riot charge remains against 180 other defendants. The complete lack of evidence to convict these defendants on, the count of incitement under any interpretation of the law, shows the prosecution's commitment to aggressively pursuing all of these charges to the bitter end. As the judge explained that there was not even a shred of evidence for incitement, Kirchhoff continued to explain her theory that seemed to equate the legal basis for engaging in a riot with inciting until the judge wouldn't hear any more. Fighting this and all charges for the remaining defendants will require lots of sustained efforts of solidarity.
Ain't nobody fresher than my motherfucking click, 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 click. As I look around, they don't do it like my click, 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 click.
Now let's get you caught up to speed. Since our last update, the police commander in charge of on-the-ground operations on J20 finished his testimony, followed by statements by a smattering of cops. Most of these cops have blended together in our memories, because a cop is a cop is a cop. But there are some highlights to share, including more insight into the Metropolitan Police Department's overt collusion with far-right groups. There was even some overtly racist testimony from one particularly combative cop who could be described as not the shiniest baton in the weapons locker. As you remember, Commander Keith DeVille's cross-examination was paused for the weekend at questions about his biases against Jewish people, queer people, and trans people. When his cross-examination continued on Monday, December 4th, he admitted to being disciplined by the Internal Affairs Division because of disparaging remarks he made about a trans police officer. No one in attendance was surprised about how he minimized his transphobia, or how he later claimed to have absolutely no bias against anyone. The cross-examination of DeVille continued with more questions about bias against the protesters who attended the march that day. After the inauguration, he told the Internal Affairs Division that the police that day had acted with enormous restraint. On the one hand, he admitted that he could not say for certain that every single cop on the street demonstrated enormous restraint in every single act. How could he? When the jury was shown video after video of the cops dousing people with pepper spray and knocking them down with batons. On the other hand, he admitted that he was aware that the police have been sued for misconduct and abuse that occurred on J20. He also admitted that the MPD's civil liability would be reduced if the prosecutor, Jennifer Kirchhoff, got convictions in these outlandish conspiracy trials. DeVille's testimony attempted to do much more than just justify police abuses and massive police expenditures on Inauguration Day. He was adamant about describing the anti-capitalist, anti-fascist march on J20 as a group that moved as a whole, acted as a whole, and reabsorbed people after they emerged to commit violence and criminal acts. This narrative of the march being a core group acting in concert with a single criminal purpose could not have been articulated better by Jennifer Kirchhoff herself. And, of course, the police commander's testimony would do nothing aside from attempting to justify these politically motivated charges. After all, he knows exactly how much money is on the line if lawsuits about police abuse and brutality are successful. After DeVille finally got off the stand and stopped spewing his carefully crafted lies, a procession of cops took the stand to testify about various pieces of so-called evidence and to confirm through their testimony and body-worn cameras that the defendants on trial were in fact arrested on J20. Much of this evidence included nefarious objects such as, wait for it, backpacks, gloves, a quote, scarfy thing, photographic equipment, and a medic kit worn around the waist like a fanny pack or a utility belt. Line cops speaking to the obvious seems like a pretty safe way to approach a trial, but it backfired on Kirchhoff when a racist, argumentative cop took the stand. Enter Michael Howden, the Scooter Squad cop. Howden gets the gold star for his overt racism being inversely proportionate to his intelligence. He spent much of his questioning by Kirchhoff explaining how he had accidentally failed to turn on his body-worn camera because, you know, buttons are confusing. And since his body-worn camera wasn't on the first 20 minutes or so, it failed to capture the moments when he was attacked, first by a pole-wielding protester, and second by a spiked hammer that bounced off his body. Seems that Howden had some extremely bad luck when his camera was off, as no other cop on the streets that day reported suffering so many attacks. Fortunately for Howden, and according to his repeated testimony, he had sunglasses that helped protect him from these attacks. I'm sorry. Fortunately for Howden, and according to his repeated testimony, he had sunglasses that helped protect him from these attacks. Those must have been some amazing sunglasses. Howden also testified that these magic sunglasses helped protect him from the pepper spray in the air that day. During cross-examination, he was asked if he ever described other police officers' use of pepper spray on J-20 as, quote, extremely wild, as he had been sprayed by other cops. He denied saying this at first, but then this hilarious exchange happened. We'll do a little reenactment. Defense attorney. So you told the captain that the police were extremely wild with pepper spray that day? Howden. I said something about wild. Defense attorney. Would it help if we replayed the clip? The clip meant a snippet of his body-worn camera video. Howden then responded, I mean, you can replay it if you'd like, but I think you're taking something out of context. Clearly, Officer Howden does not understand that body-worn cameras ostensibly capture the context of the situation police are in, and that the videos that they take are, in fact, evidence. Yet Howden's comments did not stop at calling the wanton deployment of pepper spray that day extremely wild. He also boasted to another cop that kettling protesters on J-20 was like herding people at Berry Farms. Berry Farms in District 7 is a public housing project in a historically black part of D.C. where police have a reputation for being extremely abusive. Racist remarks from a cop are not surprising, of course. But what is surprising is that among all the cops who helped kettle more than 200 people in the streets that day, this cop was one of the best that Kirchhoff could present to the jury. And lest we forget, there was also testimony from a rogue cowboy cop, Harrison Grubbs. His noteworthy contribution to keeping the streets safe on Inauguration Day was running his bicycle directly into a protester and subsequently falling off and fracturing his wrist. It turns out that human bodies can suffer injuries upon impact with concrete, which would be good for cops in general to understand since they're so quick to throw people in the streets to the ground, or worse, to ensure, quote, public safety. Detective Gregory Pemberton, the treasurer of Washington, D.C.'s police union, and the lead detective on the case, testified for a full 4 days this past week. Pemberton was assigned to the case on January 20th while defendants were still detained at 12th and L, despite that area being out of his usual jurisdiction. Pemberton testified that he'd been working overtime every week in order to watch hundreds of hours of video to identify every person who was arrested and their every action during the march, in what he claims is the biggest case of his career. His testimony primarily consisted of large poster board graphics for each defendant, featuring chronological screenshots alleged to show their action during the march. Each screenshot was accompanied by a video montage to highlight each person's conduct, which for the most part included such menacing acts as walking down the street and being kettled by the police with no option to leave. Oftentimes, the identification of defendants hinged on nothing more than a particular item that Pemberton tracked. In one case, a regular water bottle in a black backpack. Pemberton wasn't allowed to outwardly identify each defendant as he gave his presentation, and it will be up to the jury to decide if there is enough evidence to prove the people in the images are the current defendants beyond a reasonable doubt. Cross-examination of Pemberton revealed his alignment with various alt-right outlets and figures, including Breitbart News, the publication of the infamous Steve Bannon, and Poll, a well-known white supremacist outlet. Pemberton also liked and retweeted several tweets that called Black Lives Matter activists liars and accused them of pushing false narratives about police killings of unarmed people of color, although there is plenty of evidence to the contrary in D.C. alone. Despite the judge claiming that BLM and the inauguration defendants had nothing in common, the defense showed footage of the marchers chanting Black Lives Matter, repeatedly implying that Pemberton may have taken out his personal biases against the arrestees. This is especially suspect since members of Pemberton's District 7 were disciplined last July for wearing t-shirts to court that featured a popular white supremacist symbol. After media outlets posted several questionable tweets from Pemberton's union Twitter, he locked his account in the middle of his testimony in an attempt to hide his bias. However, Unicorn Riot was able to save and archive all his tweets before he locked it, and now they are publicly available. When he's not dodging questions to preserve the government's narrative, Pemberton spends his spare time watching and following defendants in and out of court, in a desperate attempt to find any scrap of information that might verify the prosecution's ridiculous charges. Other MPD testimony included that of investigator Robert Rank, who was in plain clothes and embedded, along with at least two other cops, in the anti-capitalist and anti-fascist march on January 20th. Rank described the march in detail, but again failed to speak to any particularized evidence on the current defendants. He admitted that there was an enormous amount of noise, and between cheering, chanting, sirens, and other chaos, he could not differentiate between sounds or hear anything particular. Additionally, Rank said he stayed toward the back of the march and therefore couldn't see most of the property damage occur, giving strength to the defense argument that it would be impossible for any one person to perceive everything that was going on. Eventually, Rank became so fearful of being hurt by the police, who didn't know he was a cop at the time, that he scurried away from the group and the massive deluge of OC spray raining upon the protesters by identifying himself as MPD and getting behind the police line. If only the rest of the protesters were lucky enough to have an easy out like Rank, instead of being beaten and pepper sprayed as they were herded down the street by police. Once the prosecution rested, the defense gave a very brief case that consisted of a handful of character witnesses. Since the onus is on the government to prove their case, the defense doesn't need to call nearly as many witnesses. Yet multiple people took the stand to attest to the general good nature of various defendants they know and work with, including one defendant's boss, a nurse who has worked alongside the defendant with cancer patients. Kirchhoff repeatedly objected to the testimony, especially when the witness tried to explain how the defendant could calmly respond to aggressive or disoriented patients whose mental capacities are failing due to brain cancer or other instances of the defendant working with cancer patients. Kirchhoff also tried to keep the witness from discussing how the defendant had to leave their job and dear patients in order to go to this circus of a trial. Upon cross-examination, Kirchhoff became heated and aggressively tried to bully the witness into impossible yes or no questions, including if her opinion of her employee would change if she knew the defendant was in a group that broke windows on Inauguration Day. "I'm not quick to judge someone," she calmly replied. "If there were a behavior that was concerning to me, I'd want to have a conversation with someone to understand more about it." After this messy and overtly aggressive cross-examination, Kirchhoff only very briefly cross-examined the other character witnesses, though she took the opportunity to limit favorable testimony for the defense as much as possible. Following the government and defense cases, the hearing for the motion for judgment of acquittal began. While the hearing had the benefit of getting one of the charges dropped for these defendants, something almost unheard of in the courts, since the judge is required to view the evidence in the light most favorable for the government when ruling, there were several concerning comments made by the judge in her explanation of why she wouldn't drop the other charges. The judge agreed with Kirchhoff's argument that for multiple city blocks before the final arrest at 12th and L, people were free to leave.
Despite police body cam video showing officers bragging about hurting people and plenty of video showing police moving behind and beside the crowd, spraying gallons of pepper spray, pushing people with batons, and yelling, "Move! Move!" over and over again. In the government's opinion, if people didn't want to participate in the alleged riot, they should have stopped at that point. Apparently, when cops yell, "Move!" and you move, you are aiding in a criminal conspiracy and willfully remaining in furtherance of a riot. According to Kirchhoff, the cops were trying to move around the crowd, and by not moving out of the way, the defendants were willfully remaining. Again, never once did the MPD issue a dispersal order during the 33-minute-long march. Despite the lack of a dispersal order, the prosecution remains committed to the idea that everyone present willfully chose to remain to further the conspiracy to riot after the first window broke. Mere presence becomes affirmative conduct, and the judge called the march a swarm with centripetal gravitational force that moved together. On that video, it is pretty obvious it is just a crowd of people generally moving together because they had nowhere else to go, and the police were, in their own words, hurting them. In response to video evidence showing a defendant passing a broken window and very clearly not noticing it, the judge claimed that the senses are 360 degrees, despite the countless videos and testimony depicting the chaos of the moment. Sirens, yelling, chanting, as well as Rank's testimony that he himself couldn't see much property damage happen, even though he was looking for it. This affirmative conduct is, in the court's view, legally reasonable as aiding and abetting the alleged rioters, and under liability laws, even evidence for a reasonable juror to find medics, a live streamer, and any other protesters wearing black guilty on all remaining charges. Now that the government and defense have both rested their case, discussions about jury instructions and closing arguments have begun. Closing arguments will be wrapping up shortly, with jury deliberation expected to begin next Monday. Keep an eye out for another podcast covering the closing arguments set to come out once all the arguments have been made.
Whatever happens in these trials will surely set precedent for future resistance. Trump has wasted no time attacking and violently disrupting vulnerable communities. Trump's attacks on political opponents and foreign leaders are echoed by his increasing attacks on communities of color, Muslims, immigrants, queer and trans people, women, and the poor. And this is only the beginning of his presidency. Resistance will only become more necessary in the future, and we must do everything we can to protect our ability to defend ourselves. Your freedom and future are at stake in this as well. Get informed. Go to the website at www.defendj20resistance.org to get further details on the case and updates as they come out. Spread the word. A lot of people don't know about the case or understand how it's relevant to them. Talk to people about the case and follow at defendj20 on Twitter and at defendj20resistance on Facebook for articles and updates you can share with others. Fundraise and donate. Many defendants do not live in DC and have to travel long distances to attend mandatory court dates. Every little bit you can donate goes directly towards supporting defendants and fighting for their freedom. Host a fundraiser or ask people you know to donate. Take action. Check out our website for details on petitions, ongoing campaigns, and other ways you can directly help support J20 defendants. But most importantly, keep resisting. Join us in continuing to condemn Trump, the threat that he poses to the entire world, and all of the violent behavior and bigotry he perpetuates and encourages.